Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a longtime Democratic campaign strategist and political media consultant, Bill Zimmerman, and discuss what Obama has to do tonight to make up for not challenging the overnight brand new centrist Romney, who repudiated almost his entire campaign so far and won over a lot of swing voters in the last debate. Then we will speak with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, about the asset stripper posing as a job creator, Mitt Romney. We will discuss the extent to which Democrats have failed to inform the public about how Wall Street is fleecing the average American at the gas pump and the kitchen table by driving up the price of commodities, a parasitic and predatory activity that is likely to get worse in a Romney administration. Then finally, Chrystia Freeland joins us. She is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital and the author of the new book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. We will discuss the disdain that Romney expressed for the 47% that the super-rich share and their irrational anger and hatred of Obama that has them throwing money at Romney to defeat a president who has been so good to them. And joining us now is Bill Zimmerman, an author and longtime activist and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants, who is the co-founder of Zimmerman and Markman Incorporated. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org, and in the 1980s, he specialized in candidate races. His successful clients included Senator Tim Worth, Senator Gary Hart, and Governor Tony Anaya. He's the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Zimmerman.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
And on the eve of this second and very crucial presidential debate, you've obviously been there in the back rooms with candidates, having worked on a number of Senate and presidential campaigns for Democrats. What would your advice be to the president, given that he was so roundly criticized by his own party for not manning up in the last one and not taking on Romney's blizzard of lies? I'm just curious how you can refute a blizzard of lies at the same time get your own agenda across.
Well, that's a good question. I think you have to look at these presidential debates in the same way that a campaign manager looks at television advertising. You have to first consider who the audience you're trying to reach is and what the best message for reaching those people might be. The president tonight needs to speak to voters who are undecided, and he needs to speak to voters who support him but are less motivated and may not turn out on Election Day. In other words, he's got to fire up his base and try to convert the few undecideds that are still out there. Most of those people don't necessarily want to see a fire-breathing candidate. Most of them, when the candidates in a debate start arguing with each other, get turned off to both. So the president has to guard against being too aggressive tonight. Many of his supporters want to see him come out swinging against Romney based on the performance in the last debate, but that isn't necessarily the best way to win over the voters that he still has to convince to vote for him. He needs to project an image of the future that's positive. He needs to tell these voters that the slow, steady progress that his administration has made is the best bet for the future. A lot of these voters are going to be tempted to adopt a quick-fix solution to their economic problems, which remain severe. And Romney is projecting a quick-fix solution, which is tempting to those voters, given the economic suffering that they've endured for the last 4 years since the recession. Obama has to explain to them that slow, steady progress is a much better strategy for the future than the quick fix that Romney is trying to tempt them with. It's a little bit like the race between the tortoise and the hare. The hare stands to get there faster, but that path comes with greater risks, and the slow, steady progress that the president has made is a better bet. Now, that's a hard sell, though, to people who are suffering from the economic disasters that this country's endured in the last 4 years. So he's got to walk a line between being inspirational, projecting realistic solutions for the future, and taking advantage of the fact that the public trusts him more than they trust Romney. They know him better. They like him more. All of the polls are showing that most voters will trust Obama at much higher levels than Romney. So he's got to take advantage of that. A lot of his supporters, especially people like you and I and the listeners of KPFK, would like to see a very aggressive populist president in this debate. But that's not who this president is. And we can't ask him to change his personality just because Romney performed well in the last debate. I think the other thing we can look for tonight is an attempt by the president to debunk some of Romney's newly found moderate positions. In that last debate, we saw a very different Romney than we had seen in the primary, someone who was moving to the center of the political spectrum from extremes on the right. Most of these undecided voters aren't that familiar with the Romney of the past, and the Romney of the present, the new moderate Romney, will appear interesting to people and credible to the voters that both candidates are targeting in this debate. So I think the president has to do something to remind people of who Romney was until the last debate. That is, he has to remind them of some of the positions that he's taken, especially the extreme hard right positions that he's now trying to repudiate. So I think the president has to take advantage of a couple of opportunities this evening to point out to viewers that Romney was taking positions quite different only a couple of months ago than those he's likely to be taking in the debate tonight.
Well, Bill Zimmerman, again, author, longtime activist, one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants, and he has worked on a number of successful Senate and presidential campaigns. What you're telling us is what he should have done in the last debate. So you got to make up for that, because there's no question that Romney made a very clever tactical decision to suddenly become a centrist on the first debate, not earlier as most political pros expected him to pivot yes. back. And of course, he made the calculation that a lot of people will be seeing him for the first time. And in fact, 70 million people saw him. And clearly that is why he's had this bump in the polls. It does make you wonder about the extent to which people pay attention in this country. But I recall when I hosted you and Dan Schneer at the UCLA Hemmer Forum talking about political campaigns, that what was most disturbing, what you both told us, is that American democracy is about most of the money that's raised by candidates from special interests pouring into swing states, which is about 20% of the country. They only know that the election's going on. We barely know what's happening here in California. And then as you get closer to the election in the last few weeks, the swing voters, or as they are euphemistically called, the low information voters, are the ones that you target. And they are, you know, frankly, not really particularly, what can I say? The euphemism is low information voters. But the notion that the electorate that we're targeting, or that professionals are targeting, is so capricious and so fickle and so ill-informed is incredibly depressing.
Well, it is depressing, and that's what's happened to our electoral system with regard to the presidency, because we elect the president not with a national election, but with 50 separate state elections. The presidency is under the control of the Electoral College. When you have separate state elections, you can ignore those states where you know the outcome in advance. States like New York and California will vote overwhelmingly Democratic in a presidential election, just as a state like Texas will vote overwhelmingly Republican. Once you know that, you can narrow down the field to, in this race, it's only been 7 or 8 states. And those states receive all of the TV advertising and all of the focus of presidential visits. But within those states, you're actually only interested in a very small minority of voters. The last 5% or so who tonight remain undecided or persuadable in this election. And if you think about who an undecided persuadable voter is in a place like Ohio that's been bombarded by a deluge of political advertising for weeks and months right now, if you remain undecided in that environment, you're a pretty disinterested voter, someone who doesn't care much about the issues or doesn't understand them. And it's in the hands of such people that we leave the decision as to who will be our next president. It's not the best way to run a government or elect a leader.
And Bill Zimmerman, my fear here is that in 2004, the election was close and it was decided in Ohio. And there's a lot of evidence that all kinds of voter suppression went on in Ohio, and that that Kerry should have won, but he would have ended up in a difficult situation where he would have won the Electoral College. But Bush, I think, was 2.4 million ahead in the popular vote.
Yes.
Obviously, Florida didn't bother Bush and the Republicans, the fact that they were 660,000 behind in the popular vote, but yet won the Electoral College by somewhat dubious means, or actually by the intervention of the Supreme Court. We could end up with a similar situation, could we not, where Obama wins the Electoral College but may not win the popular vote?
Well, that's possible. It's unusual. The example you pointed out in 2004 is probably the best historical example of what could happen. I was working in Ohio trying to carry the state for Kerry in 2004. And those of us who were there were convinced that we won the state. And it wasn't just voter suppression. It was actually cheating that took place under the leadership of the state's then Secretary of State, Kenneth Blackwell, a Republican, who was running the election apparatus in Ohio at the time. And you're right to point out that if Kerry had carried Ohio, he would have become the president and would have lost the general election by over 2 million votes. And that was because of the strength of the southern vote. Bush had won the states in the old Confederacy by a margin of 5.5 million votes. Kerry carried the rest of the country by 2 million votes. So because the conservative Republican ideology is so overwhelmingly popular in the southeastern portion of the United States, the old Confederacy that was defeated in the Civil War, they have come to exert an undue influence on national elections for the presidency.
But doesn't this lead one to be concerned about this election, given that Karl Rove was the architect of the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio, and he's now the de facto head of the Republican Party, and he is obviously working overtime, not just raising billions through super PACs that don't have to declare who their donors are. You know, they're suppressing voters who are registered voters and who voted before. They have to prove who they are, but plutocrats giving to secret super PACs don't have to reveal who they are. That's the landscape that we have, and Karl Rove is obviously at it again. So my feeling is that Obama doesn't just have to win this election. He has to win it fairly substantially, because the closer it is, the more likely that Karl Rove will steal it.
Well, that's possible. You're absolutely right. But you also have to remember that in 2008, we learned our lesson. And the Obama campaign put together a massive field operation that was run in a very sophisticated manner. That field operation is even more sophisticated today. And it is on the ground in all the places where cheating can take place, and they are closely monitoring the situation. And I think, as you've noticed in the last couple of weeks, we've been winning most of the court cases against the voter suppression laws. Those laws are still on the books, and we're going to have to fight them again after the election, but it looks like in most cases they are not going to be allowed to impact this election. That's not to say we don't have to be vigilant against the kind of cheating you're describing. And we also have to be vigilant about the issue of money in politics. I mean, this election, more than any other in our history, demonstrates the corrosive aspects of unlimited contributions to political campaigns. And we have got to take on as a long-term priority getting money out of politics and having all elections be publicly financed with no private money involved at all. Only then are we going to have a government that it is truly representative of the people and able to be responsive to the issues that affect people.
Well, Bill Zimmerman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome, Ian. Glad to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Zimmerman, who is an author, longtime activist, and one of the nation's most experienced political media consultants and the co-founder of Zimmerman & Markman, Inc. Previously, he was a strategic communications consultant to MoveOn.org, and in the 1980s, he specialized in candidate races. His successful clients include Senator Tim Worth, Senator Gary Hart, and Governor Tony Anaya. He's the author of Troublemaker, a memoir from the front lines of the 60s. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the Democrats have failed to inform the public about how Wall Street is fleecing the average American at the gas pump and the kitchen table.
Don't need to change the future's odd. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
That you want me to do. Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me doing everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, yeah. Watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently is the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and seminars on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
Nice to be here.
And tonight in this critical second debate, I imagine that what Mitt Romney will be doing, which is what his vice president said in his closing remarks in the vice presidential debate, that the choice America has is somebody that's not providing jobs for America, the incumbent. And wouldn't it be perfect for America to be run by a job creator? Now, my understanding is that this man's career is not one of so much of job creation, but of being an asset stripper. And he's also somebody that's opposed to the Dodd-Frank legislation, even though he said in the last debate that he approves of it or most of it. So what do you make of these economic arguments that are out there on the part of the Republicans and the kind of weak response that the Democrats have put forth?
Well, I think the arguments border on, by the Republicans border on being frivolous. And, of course, that makes the weak response, especially in the president's first debate performance, that much more remarkable. Basically, Obama may be faulted, and many progressives have faulted him in undershooting the original stimulus package, which was $800 billion. Most progressives and even his economic advisor, Dr. Romer, was recommending $1.3 trillion. Larry Summers wrote it back down to $800 billion. Half of that was tax cuts that had no stimulus effect. Had he, when he had 59 Democratic senators or 60 Democratic senators, pushed through a larger stimulus package, I think unemployment would be well below 7.8% as it is today. But there can be no mistake about it. I think the thing that's been underemphasized, Obama keeps saying generally he took over and the economy was in terrible shape. I think that understates the fact. The economy was headed off of an economic cliff. Even conservative economists were agreed that unless something dramatic was done, we were going to be in the second Great Depression. And unemployment wouldn't be at 7.8% 10% today. It might be as high as 15% today. And he did head that off. He did enough to head that off. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month when he took over. And now we're at a net gain of jobs. So if it hadn't been for Obama's response, which wasn't as strong as it could have been, and he could have made himself absolutely invulnerable by a stronger response, we wouldn't be where we are today. And frankly, when you talk about Mitt Romney's plan, you have to look no further than his chief economic advisor, who is Glenn Hubbard, who was President George W. Bush's chief economic advisor. And Glenn Hubbard and the Bush economic team took this country off an economic cliff. And on that front, on the judges' front, where he's got Robert Bork giving him advice, on foreign policy, he's got neocons giving him advice. He wants to return, there's no doubt about it, to the era of George W. Bush. And George W. Bush, in terms of the economy, drove us right up to the point of the second Great Depression. And whatever Barack Obama's shortcomings may be, he got us back into a situation where the economy is growing. The final thing I would say is Obama in his third and fourth year finally understood that he needed more stimulus, but by that time the Republicans were in control of the House, and they filibustered everything the president wanted to do in the Senate. He couldn't even fill his executive branch. He can't get his judges through, not because a majority of the Senate is opposed to what he wants to do, but because it only takes 41 senators to stop the president. He said very little about that obstructionism, and I think a lot of the shortcoming of where we are in the economy falls right in the lap of the Republicans, but unfortunately the president hasn't yet made that case.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. He also teaches constitutional law and seminars on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. And we've spoken a lot about what's happening in terms of the price of gasoline and the price of foods being artificially driven up by gaming on Wall Street through the Goldman Sachs index. The consumers, just here in California, by the way, Michael, we just had the gasoline go up astronomically and prompting our two senators to look into how much the market is being gamed. But the idea that you would have a presidential candidate who represents the people who game the commodities market in order to make profits at the expense of the average citizen who gets hurt every time they go to the pump and every time they go to the supermarket, and it doesn't contribute anything to the greater good. It is just pure predatory capitalism. I'm astounded that the Democrats can't make that distinction.
Well, yes, you're quite right to be astounded. First of all, Romney would take us right back to an era. I mean, when you say he said he supported most of Dodd-Frank, he was very careful about what he said. He said he supported some regulation. He didn't want banks opening in garages. I don't think one could expect that a President Romney would be very tough on Wall Street. In fact, I think he would allow Wall Street to do whatever it wanted to do. There can be very little doubt about that. The president has several times, once in March 2011, again in March 2012, and then in the Rose Garden, April 17, 2012, has correctly targeted the culprit in gas prices being market manipulation by Wall Street banks. And the sad thing about that is he can't seem to get his own administration to organize itself to do anything about that. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We saw the worst-case scenario in his first presidential debate. The president is insular and has been passive in following up his own intellectual theses, but there can be no doubt that whatever a second Obama term will be, it will be much tougher on Wall Street, much tougher on this problem than would be true with a President Romney. President Romney would turn his back on all meaningful regulation. We'd be right back where we were on September 14, 2008, which is many financial products, trillions of dollars of financial products, completely unregulated outside the rule of law. Dodd-Frank corrected a lot of that. It's been slow being implemented, but there can be no doubt when you have the option between a second Obama administration and an administration for Mitt Romney, that if you really want to see Wall Street take over the economy and you really want to see suffering and high gas prices and high food prices, that's exactly what's going to happen if Mitt Romney is elected president.
And Michael Greenberger, there's no question that Obama got the lion's share of Wall Street money in 2008. But now Wall Street appears to hate him. Wall Street billionaire likened Obama's election to the rise of Hitler. And there is a lot of anger and bitterness, and all of the Wall Street money is pouring into Mitt Romney's coffers. And it's interesting that just to note that J.P. Morgan Chase just posted record profits. What's their complaint, for God's sake? Yeah. Obama's presiding over an incredibly good economy for Wall Street. They've been made whole. They're doing not better than ever, but as good as they've ever done. The stock market is booming. I don't understand what their complaints are.
Well, what they're complaining about is as much as a half measure as it has been, the Obama administration, first of all, by supporting Dodd-Frank and then by implementing it, not as aggressively as many of us would like to see, but implementing it nevertheless, a lot of the easy profits that the banks had in sort of oligopolistic markets, the so-called derivative swaps market, which is a $700 trillion notional value market worldwide, 10 times the world GDP, there were five banks pre-Dodd-Frank that controlled that market. They had oligopolistic prices. They were making reckless bets for their own book, which would be stopped by the implementation of the Volcker Rule. So, yes, they're doing well. They're doing very, very well. But their view is they should be doing that much better. A lot of the easy, low-hanging fruit, unregulated profits that they receive pre-Dodd-Frank have gone away. Whatever ambiguous statements Romney made in the first debate about Dodd-Frank, and believe me, I don't think there's any real recognition of seriously enforcing Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank has caused the banks to shrink their markets, change their game plans. The markets are much more competitive. There are more financial service providers who are now part of the market. There is competition. And this is not something that J.P. Morgan wants. They want to go back to the old system where five banks spread the profits in a $300 trillion notional value market. And they did it in a very lazy, uninspiring way. It had nothing to do with growing the economy, lending money to businesses or small businesses or people who wanted educational loans. It had to do with reckless, highly reckless bets that led to the meltdown. So they understand that their only chance to go back to where five banks essentially control the world economy, you have to elect Mitt Romney. As weak and really, if in relative terms, the Obama administration has been very kind to Wall Street. Some of these banks should have been taken over in 2009. Some of these banks are still zombie banks that may not really be solvent if accurate accounting is done. And Obama should have done much more. But he's done enough to make it clear to them that they're not going to go back to the old ways that drove us off the economic cliff in September of 2008 and took us, even Bernanke and other conservatives said at that time, and Bernanke continues to say, had the Obama administration not taken the steps it would have taken, we would have been in a second Great Depression. And Bernanke told the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that depression would have been worse than the 1930s. Obama saved us from that. He has a plan that is not as radical a return to give the banks whatever they want. One could even hope that now he's seeing that being nice to banks has no political profit for him, that they will have done nothing to help him get reelected if he is reelected, and there should be no reason in a second term for him to be pulling punches with regard to regulating banks. However, given his passive nature, one can't be certain. But what one can be certain about is that a second Obama administration will be much more helpful to the middle class and will be more assertive against these banks than anything Mitt Romney or the Republican Party can offer.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. He also teaches constitutional law and seminars on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. You had an article recently, Michael Greenberger, in The Nation about the possibility of the courts, even the Supreme Court, undoing Dodd-Frank in the radical way that they eviscerated campaign finance rules with the Citizens United decision. Recently, a judge, in fact, it was an Obama appointee, gave a victory to Wall Street by essentially scrapping the provisions in Dodd-Frank for the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to position limits on these bets that they take that drive up the price of oil and food, etc. They use the rubric of cost-benefit analysis. That seems to be pervasive and a gift to those who don't want regulation. What's your sense of how much the judiciary is moving to the right, just as our politics are?
Well, again, you know, the judiciary is moving to the right because the president spent 4 years not making a priority, filling the vacancies that were available to him. Now, in fairness, in his second term, every vacancy virtually, or most of the important ones, have been filibustered. The most important appellate court for purposes of these regulatory issues is the D.C. Circuit. There are three Democratic eligible vacancies on that circuit that have not been filled in the first 4 years of Obama's term. He's tried to fill one of them, and the Republicans have twice filibustered that candidate. That means a minority of the Senate has stopped the president on this, as they've stopped him on many of his initiatives. But those Republican-appointed judge who still control many of these courts because of the laxity in getting Obama nominees through, have hooked their ideology on this idea of cost-benefit. And that is, even if an agency implements a statute the way Congress intended, if they don't make a finding that the benefits of their action exceed the costs, the regulatory activity is invalidated. And this so-called cost-benefit analysis, which was originated by Ronald Reagan in his first term, has become an orthodoxy among conservatives. And it's really a way for judges to second-guess congressional intent and regulatory intent. What happens in these cases, they give no deference to Congress, what Congress wants to do when it passes a statute, no deference to the administrative agency that's implementing the statute, and the judges review the rulemaking record afresh. So you've got conservative judges looking at complicated records and picking and choosing evidence that they think supports Wall Street or other big corporations, and then claiming that the evidence used by the regulators implementing congressional intent is, quote, unpersuasive, close quote. This really is a methodology of judging that goes back to the 1905 Lochner case, where that conservative court, going all the way up to 1937, was invalidating progressive state legislation and the early New Deal legislation by second-guessing what state legislatures and Congress and regulatory agencies have done and imposing their own conservative ideology. And unless, first of all, if Romney's elected with Robert Bork advising him on judicial nominees, this is going to continue, and it won't just be Dodd-Frank, but it's going to be environmental statutes, all kinds of statutes that protect the public against bad corporate policy. They will all be de facto vetoed by a policy that is a stealth second-guessing by conservative judiciary. The only hope we have for this being stopped is Obama getting reelected, and then Obama and the progressive Democratic Senate, which I hope will remain in Democratic hands, ending the filibuster's interruption of the president being able to appoint either executive branch officials or judges, and start filling the court with Obama-nominated judges. And that is the surest way to end what is a return to the kind of conservatism we saw from 1905 to 1937, where state progressive legislation and New Deal legislation was invalidated left and right under technical doctrines that were nothing more than conservative ideology presented as judicial thinking.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Greenberger.
You're welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Greenberger, who's the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, currently is the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and seminars on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chrystia Freeland, who is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Previously, she reported for the Financial Times, both in New York and London, and was the deputy editor of Canada's The Globe and Mail. She has also reported for The Economist, The Washington Post, and is the author of Sale of the Century, The Inside Story of the Second Russian Revolution. She has an article at The New Yorker, Super Rich Irony, Why Do Billionaires Feel Victimized by Obama? And her latest book just out is Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chrystia Freeland.
Thank you very much, Ian. Pleasure to be with you.
And we're on the eve of the second presidential debate between the incumbent and a certifiable representative of the 1%.
So even of the 0.01%.
And if he's to become president, do you think that we're likely to become more of a plutocracy and less of a democracy?
Well, look, I certainly think that some of the policies and some of the attitudes that we've heard from Mitt Romney would push America more in the direction of plutocracy. You know, I think the underlying forces are not actually political. I think there are some very powerful underlying economic forces, globalization and the technology revolution. But I think you can make a political choice. Is your politics going to push against a winner-take-all economy or exacerbate it? Some countries have their politics push against. You know, I think the Northern Europeans, especially the Scandinavians, have done that really well. In other countries, the politics really leans into it. And, you know, in recent decades in America, you know, the politics have been leaning into the winner-take-all economy, and I think that Romney would continue that. I was particularly struck as, you know, and I'm certainly not unique here, by his 47% remark, and why it struck me so much, as I wrote in my New Yorker piece, and actually as I write in the book, is it wasn't the first time I heard that. When Mitt Romney talked you know, I think certainly with distance and maybe a little bit of disdain about the 47%, that's something that I had been hearing from a lot of plutocrats. I think that's, if not a truth universally acknowledged in those circles, a very common way of looking at the world.
So it's also an inaccurate way of looking at Americans. Americans, I find to be incredibly industrious and hardworking, and they don't are not victims. They don't see themselves as victims. They have aspirational, both aspirational politics and aspirational economics, if you will, and they certainly are not overpaid, which is what a lot of plutocrats think. And they're very productive. I just find it extraordinary that there is this notion out there that was expressed by Mitt Romney.
Well, I agree with you, Ian. Now, judging by your accent, I'm going to hazard a guess that you are not American-born. Is that fair?
That's true. I was born in Australia. Post-convict time, but...
So I share a Commonwealth background with you because I'm Canadian, and I share maybe your slight outsider's admiration for Americans, and especially for the American middle class. You know, I think the American middle class right now is really being hammered by these economic forces of globalization, of the technology revolution. And, you know, what economists are documenting is something that they describe as the polarization of the labor market. Or, you know, one set of economists, these are actually English economists, talk about it as the division of the world into the lousy and the lovely jobs. I think that's absolutely right. And most of the jobs that the middle class does are the lousy jobs. And, you know, when people talk about the shape of the economy, as the economy recovers from recession, and I think that recovery is happening, albeit much more slowly than people would like, many of the economists I talk to say, you know, the sort of the journalistic concern is with structural unemployment. Will unemployment, you know, forever be high? A lot of economists I talk to say what you should be worried about is that structurally those middle-class jobs will become lousy, lower-paying jobs than they were before. And I do think that's happening. And what I think, you know, we have to be aware of when we think about the economy and when we think about the political economy and the politics around the economy is, you know, we're living through a tale of two cities or a tale of two economies. We're living through this period when the middle class is getting hammered because of these objective outside forces. The people at the very top are doing better than ever. And we have to understand that there are these two very distinct economic experiences happening at the very same time. And those experiences do shape the political attitudes of the people who live in these two different worlds.
And again, I'm speaking with Chrystia Freeland, who is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital, and her latest book just out is Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. And your book, Chrystia Freeland, has this wonderful cover of a Gulfstream jet parked in a suburban driveway as though it was sort of a flashback to the 50s, the Aussie and Harriet days, with a mother walking her child into the jet while other people in the background are washing their cars. This, if only it were true that the Gulf Streams were trickling down. But I spoke to somebody recently who was at Aspen at a recent conference, and they were just parked wall to wall. What I find extraordinary about the wealthy is that they're insecure, that the next mansion over in the Hamptons is bigger than theirs. Did you find that?
Absolutely. And I think, actually, that insecurity, sort of once you step into that world, the insecurity becomes less puzzling. And at least the way I explain it is it's less puzzling for two reasons. One is, there is a lot of turnover among the super rich right now. So, you know, this income inequality, this winner-take-all economy is being driven in large measure by this economic revolution we're living through. And what that means is there are lots of these thrusting outsiders pushing their way into that space. And that space is, in fact, really, really competitive. You know, this super elite, the guys who fly around on private jets, they are very, very rich, and I don't for a moment want to suggest that their lives are easier or even comparable in their difficulty to the lives of someone who is sort of towards the bottom of the middle class, working, you know, maybe two really difficult jobs to just stay afloat. I don't want to say that at all. But from the inside, these super rich guys, and they are almost exclusively men, they work long hours. They work 60, 65, 70 hours a week. A lot of them keep on working, you know, well into their 60s, into their 70s. If they are in the managerial class, they feel they could lose their jobs at any time. We just saw the CEO of Citigroup, Vikram Pandit, today effectively be kicked out by his board. Now, he was making a lot of money, but he lost his job. So, you know, there is this incredible sense of pressure, sense of, you know, there's someone who's going to eat my lunch. As Andy Grove, the founder of Intel, put it, only the paranoid survive. That's the attitude of those guys. And so I think that that is part of what drives the insecurity. The other thing that I think drives the insecurity, which again can seem so, you know, frankly surreal if you're outside this world, is income inequality. Actually, it becomes more pronounced the closer you get to the top. So, you know, Occupy Wall Street introduced this notion of the division between the 1% and the 99%. In some ways, the sense of difference and of division is as acute within the 1% as it is throughout the economy. So, you know, the millionaires, even, you know, the guys making, you know, a mere $10 million, and I have this, you know, line in my book where one of the people who lives in this world recounts a conversation among her friends where one of her friends said, you know, $20 million, it doesn't go that far. It's only $10 million after taxes. And the guys who are making a mere $20 million, I'm saying this with irony, please, they're really envious of the true billionaires. So there is that intense status anxiety even among people who really, you know, from the outside, viewed objectively, have nothing to be anxious about.
So you grew up in a social democracy in Canada, so did I. The Europeans, their social democracy is somewhat under threat, but by and large, they've found a way to take care of most of their citizens in ways that the American workers, I don't think, have any concept of how badly off they are. And what little we have in terms of a social safety net here in the United States is under threat at the moment, Social Security and Medicare being the basic achievements so far of the Democratic Party. And, of course, in the last debate, President Obama said he and Romney are on the same page vis-a-vis Social Security, which was quite astounding. How do our plutocrats feel about stepping over homeless people on their way into a fancy restaurant? That is something that you simply don't see in other countries like Australia and Canada. You don't see the refuse of our society, the human refuse, the wounded, the walking wounded in the streets in quite the way that you see here in the United States. And that's bound to grow if the disparity becomes greater and we become more and more of a plantation economy.
Yes, well, I do agree with that. One thing that I have been struck by is how Canadian I felt as I researched and really sort of dove into and wrote this book. And that sense of being very Canadian for me was really increased when I shared the book in sort of manuscript form with some of my Canadian friends, including Canadians who you would probably call plutocrats. And I was a bit anxious. You know, I thought that they might be, you know, very hostile to what I had to say. And what I found was they were just tremendously supportive. My favorite was the response I had from Paul Martin, the former Canadian Liberal Party Prime Minister and Minister of Finance, who, by the way, balanced the Canadian budget. So, you know, you can be a Liberal and also be fiscally responsible. And what was so interesting about his reaction to my book, Ian, was it really mirrored what you had to say. And, you know, Paul Martin, he's a former prime minister. He can, you know, he can schmooze with anyone he wants to in the United States. And he said he had increasingly become really alienated from and really astonished by the gap that he felt was growing between the richest Americans and everybody else. And he said he just found it sort of hard to stomach. He found it hard to understand how, you know, in particular, he said, you know, he couldn't understand how people on Wall Street could be criticizing welfare bums and, you know, talking about the entitlement state of people at the bottom when he said they've just had the biggest welfare check written to them. It was called the TARP. And this, by the way, you know, is the comment, and you know, I interviewed him for my book, and I quote him, that this is a comment from former Canadian Prime Minister, former Canadian Minister of Finance, and, by the way, also a self-made plutocrat. He made a fortune in the shipping business before he went into politics. So I do think, you know, that distance between the middle class and the poor and everybody else is particularly acute in the United States. I think that's part of the reason why there is so much hostility towards President Obama and why you hear from some people at the very top, you know, these sort of anguished cries of class warfare every time you raise the question or talk about the issue of income inequality. And someone who helped me understand this is actually a really interesting guy. If you haven't had him on your show, Ian, I urge you to do so. Called Nick Hanauer,
I have had him on, indeed, and I've played his TED Talk as often as I can.
Yeah, so Nick is great, and the way he put it to me, you know, speaking of your point about the homeless people, he said, you know, the reason the plutocrats are so hostile towards the president, the reason their reaction, he sees it as not being just about self-interest, but being an emotional one. And he says that's because otherwise they couldn't live with themselves. As long as they feel that their wealth is equivalent to their civic virtue, as long as they truly are able to believe, not just benefit from, but believe in the trickle-down economy and believe that by doing well in business, they are doing good for everybody else, they can step over that homeless person on the way to a fabulous meal in a fabulous restaurant with a clear conscience, because they can say, actually, I'm making the world better through my business. And if that person is poor, it's just because, you know, they're part of this 47% who are dependent on government. The minute you start challenging that paradigm, I think you become very morally uncomfortable.
And again, I'm speaking with Chrystia Freeland, who is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. And her latest book just out is Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. And now, in your article in New Yorker, Chrystia Freeland, the super rich irony, why do billionaires feel victimized by Obama? It is a bit surreal, given how the Obama economy has been so good to the rich. And as you point out, Manuel Sykes up there at Berkeley has found that 93% of the gains during the 2009 and 2010 recovery went to the top 1% of earners, and the top 0.1% of earners have captured 37% of the total recovery pie. So it's a bit hard to take, given that Main Street is languishing and Wall Street is thriving. And why is it then, I guess the explanation for the hatred of Obama is a little hard to understand.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I also, Ian, really find this mysterious. Because actually, you know, if you were a Martian, just looking at the economic statistics, you would say that the middle class and, you know, the working poor should be quite angry at President Obama. And Wall Street should be in love with the guy. You know, the people at the very top should think he's fantastic. The stock market now has almost returned. It's within spitting distance of its pre-crisis levels. Just think about that. So stock market has almost fully recovered. Corporate balance sheets are, you know, overflowing with cash. Companies have more money than they know how to invest right now. So objectively speaking, the super rich really haven't done that badly. And, you know, also, by the way, if we want to talk about material facts, although the president has talked about raising taxes on the super rich, he hasn't actually done it. You know, the Bush tax cuts are still in place. You know, so when I tried to explore this mystery of why, you know, despite the fact that, you know, you think of these people as being, you know, very practical, very pragmatic, very numbers-based, why are they so angry at a president who hasn't done them much material harm, if any? What I came back to really was, above all, this emotional point we're talking about. Because what Obama has done is he has had the temerity to challenge this equation, which I think has been conventional wisdom in American public life since the Reagan era, you know, that trickle-down did work. That if you create an economic order in which those at the very top can prosper, that is an economic order which is good for everybody. And President Obama has actually asked, is that the case? And in fact, he said, it's not. He's said, you know, there are some things that companies can do that can be great for the people who own those companies, that can be great for their investors, but actually may not, you know, at least in the short term, be good for the American middle class. I happen to think that he is right to observe that. But I think, you know, as our mutual friend Ian Nick Hanauer points out, that is really an existential challenge to the plutocrats.
Well, Chrystia Freeland, you certainly succeeded. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Chrystia Freeland, who is the editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Previously, she reported for the Financial Times, both in New York and London, and was the deputy editor of Canada's The Globe and Mail. She has also reported for The Economist, The Washington Post, and is the author of Sale of the Century, The Inside Story of the Second Russian Revolution. She has an article at The New Yorker, Super Rich Irony, Why Do Billionaires Feel Victimized by Obama? And her latest book just out is Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Manas and Tariq Mohammed. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half.